Welcome to the Lend Academy podcast, episode number 68. This is your host, Peter Renton, founder of Lend Academy. Today on the show, I'm delighted to welcome James Wu. He is the CEO and founder of Monja. Now, Monja is one of these new breed of companies that have become an integral part of the ecosystem, where they're really providing investors with valuable services to help them get comfortable with this asset class, help them monitor their portfolio, help them with risk management, and really get them comfortable that the decisions they're making are the right decisions. And so we talk a lot about Monja and what they're doing and how they're really helping, you know, to bring more transparency and bring more independent third-party analysis to the industry. And we talk about the lending club issues and the pullback with investors, but we also talk about delinquencies and what trends that James has been seeing there, and also what he thinks the future holds. Hope you enjoy the show. Welcome to the podcast, James.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for having me.
No, my pleasure. So let's just get started by giving the listeners a bit of background about yourself, about what you did before you started Monja.
Sure. Before Monja, I worked at a company called Morgan Stanley Capital International. So I worked really primarily focused on software products for quantitative portfolio management and risk management. So I guess a big part of my career there was, or I guess a lot of people's career, was the 2008 global financial crisis. Yeah, that was around the time when I remember helping a couple of large institutional investors really make sense of their portfolio. And the biggest problem back then was, I guess, coming down to their realization that they don't have a good way to manage their asset allocation in a quantitative way. And these are, we're not talking about small investors. These are sovereign wealth funds, public pensions, asset managers, and so on.
Sure.
Yeah. So definitely saw similar analogies in the marketplace lending space, though. I guess we're looking at, so I personally was looking at this space back in, I want to say 2014. And man, it was kind of interesting because I remember first seeing the peer-to-peer lending space back in 2006, 2007. And back then, you know, it was simply two platforms to pick from, LendingClub and Prosper, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you remember those days. And so we looked at the space in 2014, and there were a lot of different platforms, and growth of many smaller platforms just coming up every day. And, I started talking to institutional investors. So really a big problem that I saw everyone had was trying to make sense of new platforms that come up and trying to manage the complexity.
So you were talking with institutional investors while you were still at MSCI, and you were, so I'm just trying to get the, was this something that you discovered it and you were thinking about it in your spare time, but it sounds like you were, you know, you wanted to get, you were getting some feedback, you know, before you even started Monja, right?
Yeah, well, for the lawyers listening, I actually didn't start the idea since after MSCI, but
of course,
I found a lot of the problems were very similar. So back in when I was looking at the portfolio during or right after the global financial crisis, there was a sense that people didn't really know what's in their portfolio because of the growing complexity. So I guess in a way, you kind of see a similar dynamic for marketplace lending. Not that people didn't know what they own, but now that you are going beyond just two platforms, now you have dozens and dozens of platforms. And now it's not just consumer lending, but you know, small business lending, asset-backed lending, student loans, and so on. It's just a lot more complexity, and it requires really infrastructure and analytics to organize everything.
Okay, so then let's just go back then to the start of Monja, and you know, you've touched on it, but could you just maybe tease it out a little bit more about what problem you're trying to solve with Monja and what your company actually does?
Yeah, sure. So I guess this was by then, late 2014, I was able to recruit two of my co-founders, Matt Kelso and Jesse Velez. So we got together, and I guess we're really trying to answer some very simple questions for investors. I guess really two questions. One is, what have I invested and how is it working out for me? And another one is, if you're looking ahead, what should I really be investing? And it sounds deceptively simple, but these are questions that obviously drive to the core of the investment process.
Mm-hmm. So you're talking about what you should invest in as far as within a platform. I mean, what do you mean? That's a fairly broad statement. So what you should invest on as far as the asset class versus other asset classes or within a particular platform? Just tease it out a little bit more.
Sure. It's for a institutional investor, the problem kind of organizes itself in this way. So one, yes, obviously, should you invest in marketplace lending versus another asset class versus other asset classes? You know, what's the relative return, expected losses, and so on. And then once you look in this asset class and decide you want to invest, what platforms should you be investing? What asset types should you be investing? And what's the relative returns and the relative risk between the different pockets? And of course, once you get really deep into it, it comes down to what risk level should you be investing, specifically which loans should you be actively selecting loans, and so on. So it's a hierarchy of different questions that an investor needs to run through from the top to bottom, really understanding what are the opportunities for investments and what should you really invest.
Okay, so you've got, I see on your website here, you've got, you know, four different solutions: performance attribution, loan scoring, portfolio monitoring, risk management. But this is all solutions, I'm guessing, specifically for institutional investors. Is that's your core constituency, right?
That's exactly right, Peter.
What kind of investors are you working with today?
When we first started working out, we primarily work with hedge funds and asset managers, really those who are directly purchasing whole loans and most of the time need to select loans or select platforms. We've expanded quite a bit. So now we also work with banks, broker-dealers, and so on, people who have exposures to these loans on their balance sheet, whether it's direct purchasing or in deals that they are, the loans that they're purchasing for securitizations. So help them with things like behavioral modeling for prepayment risk, for delinquencies and losses and so on. And they're also, I guess, branching into middle market lending for people who provide credit facilities, debt facilities for balance sheet lenders. Again, coming back to our core competency of being able to apply predictive analytics on loans.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So then, and the one thing I think, I'm not sure whether, I think it was one of your blog posts, you talked about bringing more transparency to peer-to-peer lending. So I could see how, you know, a lot of the things you're doing there really is helping the investor. But how are you bringing more transparency?
Look, a lot of people have been talking about transparency for a while, and I think platforms are generally getting better at it, and we're getting pretty good at it by providing data. And I think there are also other vendors out there. A lot of people talk about standardizing data, and I think that's obviously a good first step. Mm-hmm. But for us, it's about, I guess, peeling the onion and pulling the data into the right models and right analytics to help on the investment process that I mentioned earlier. I can give you one example.
Sure.
I remember one time we were walking investors through a dashboard, and this was a passive forward flow portfolio. They were supposed to be getting a fair slice of a platform's origination. And then we dug into the portfolio. The aha moment was you started seeing the portfolio having a 50 basis point, 100 basis point lower expected return compared to the platform average. And then you look at it deeper, it comes down to, you know, the DTI is just a little higher. The average income is just a little bit lower. You know, sometimes it's not a huge amount of discrepancy, but being able to have the right framework and the right model to look at the data, it goes a long way.
Okay. So then I'm just curious, do you, like, brings up an interesting point. Do you work with both investors who are doing you know, passive allocations, like you mentioned, and those that are also sort of running their own models and doing, you know, doing their own cherry picking, shall we say. Do you work with both kinds of investors?
We do, and the distinction is less than you think. So nowadays, a lot of the passive investors would have credit box around what they want to buy, things they want to exclude. You know, at the end of the day, even if you're passive, you still want to be vigilant in understanding what's going into your portfolio.
Sure.
Yeah. It's obviously, from a selection perspective, there is a difference between actively, quote unquote, cherry picking. I hate that term, but it's catchy. The difference between that and really doing the selection on a criteria basis, it just comes down to the mechanism of connection. But yeah, both are getting the same types of benefit from working with us.
Right. And I mean, you say cherry picking. I mean, even if a person is an institution is a passive investor, they have a credit box, they are doing some sort of selections, shall we say. You know, even if it's just saying, right, we don't want any F or G loans or even saying we don't want certain DTIs. I presume most people are not just buying the index, right? Buying every single loan. Most investors are at least have some kind of selection criteria, right?
Yeah, Peter, that's exactly right. And for us, it's obviously about helping investors craft that criteria. But back to, you know, earlier you asked about the solutions. One of the things we help people look at their portfolio is performance attribution. So it goes something like this. Say a manager is investing with the lending club in the D's and E category. We can look at the portfolio and say, hey, you've invested in a segment that has a higher ability to pay compared to the benchmark. And this adds exactly, you know, somewhere between 25 to 35 basis points to your portfolio return. So that ability to quantify and almost like playing X-ray on the portfolio, that really helps tying it back to the investment process and the results.
Right. So you obviously, to do this, you have had to create your own benchmark, right? So you're looking at, you've obviously, I presume you've taken the history of whatever platform it is and created your own benchmark. And obviously I presume it's a flexible benchmark. So if you say I'm doing D and E grade loans with a DTI of less than 25%, you can create a benchmark just based on that, right? And then compare their selections to that benchmark. Is that what you're talking about? Or are you talking about just the overall platform benchmark?
Yes, Peter, that's exactly right. And as you probably know, for many years, I worked for a large benchmark provider. Right. So benchmark by itself in isolation is not that meaningful. We don't think it stands alone. But for us, creating the right benchmark, it comes down to having the ability to slice and dice against it and to do meaningful comparison like what you just talked about.
Right, because it's not one benchmark, because one benchmark's kind of irrelevant unless you're buying the index or buying across all kinds of loans, because you're going to, if you've got a bank who's saying, I'm only going to buy A-grade loans, that's it. You know, they're going to want a benchmark just on the A-grade loans. So it sounds like what your technology does is create a benchmark based on the entire loan history from which they can then compare what they're doing with that history.
Yes, and that fit on the benchmark is extremely important, because that bank that you're talking about, it's not fair to compare their return versus a higher risk portfolio, you know, portfolios that have D's and E loans in it, simply because this is a manager that's taking a much lower risk and has a much safer portfolio.
Okay, so then how are you taking into account, like, are you just really basing everything on past performance? I mean, are you taking into account macro environment? Obviously, we've seen like four interest rate hikes in at Lending Club, multiple at Prosper in recent months. I mean, and obviously that changes the dynamics of the return dynamics, because not every loan grade is increased evenly, and other platforms have had different changes as well. So just explain how, like backward looking, you know, are you taking in multiple variables? What are you, how does it work?
We definitely take multiple variables into account, and we do it in a way that's cross-platform. And that really gets you away from the fallacy of looking simply at past performance. Mm-hmm. If you simply look at the past performance of a platform, then you don't really catch the risk factor in which they are, shall we say, deviating away from their investment criteria, their underwriting criteria from the past. And in fact, that was what we saw in some of the 2015 vintages, where platforms, because they are under pressure to underwrite more, they're under pressure to originate more volume, in a way loosen some of their underwriting criteria. And if you're simply looking at the platform performance, you can't see that. But by looking across many, many different underwriting level variables, you can see those trends and translate to what the expected returns are.
Right. So related to this benchmarking, I'm curious about the indexes that you have, and maybe, I don't know whether readers might not realize the sort of work you're doing here. You know, it looks like you've got some information that's, you know, it's publicly available on your website. You've got, consumer lending index, obviously focused on the marketplace lending industry. You've got a consumer lending, you've got a small business. Just tell us a little bit about the indexes and what goes into that.
The indexes on the construction, we take the larger platforms in each of the segments. So whether it's consumer or small business, and reconstruct the return time series for the index. So effectively, this is a set of returns that you would get if you passively replicate the portfolio in a way that's similar to the index. Now, Peter, I guess related to your earlier comment, nobody really completely replicates this index. So this is a starting point, generally speaking, for investors that we help benchmarking. We create a set of custom indexes that measure specifically in the criteria that they are investing in.
Right. Okay. So I want to move on a little bit and just talk about the Lending Club. I'm sure you've got many investors who are clients that are of yours that are investing on Lending Club. What have you, and it's looking at the data and, just give me your take on, and we're recording this, in mid-June, and, just to give people some context here, like what are you seeing with Lending Club these days?
Obviously, the news at Lending Club was a big shock to everybody, and really highlights the importance of transparency being a big issue. So, stating the obvious, Lending Club has their work cut out for them. They really need to find ways to restore the confidence of investors. So I guess from our end, we see investors pull back immediately after the announcement, after the news broke. And yet at the same time, we're seeing some signs that investors are returning to their platform. Mm-hmm. But I mean, obviously, there's still obvious risk factors ahead, and there's a risk that they're not going to sustain the volume that's in line with their cost structure. So there's probably something they need to do there. They do have their liquidity cushion on their side, and that's a good thing if Lending Club were to either change their business model, in a sense, maybe buy more on balance sheet or need other accommodations. That's obviously a good thing, having that cushion. Mm-hmm. But obviously, still challenges ahead.
Right. So, and what about other platforms that, we've obviously got Prosper, but there's many others in the consumer space that institutional investors are participating in. Are you seeing this ripple across, or do you feel like, and obviously Lending Club's had the biggest impact, from what I've heard and from what others have said, but are you seeing this ripple effect, where we're well over a month removed from from the news? I mean, like, people have had some time to digest it. Where are you seeing things land today?
I think for investors that understand the asset class fairly well, there's I guess I'm pleasantly surprised that many of them are are pretty understanding about, well, about the potential challenges, but also about understanding this is not the end of the world. In context, this is obviously a problem on Lending Club, but the larger case, you know, the bull case for the business plan for this business model has not gone away. Mm-hmm. So I think certainly for investors who see the fundamentals, there's definitely still a good amount of confidence. But for investors that were evaluating the asset class, this is probably, I think it pushes back some deals, some of the investment capital that were going to come into this space, that it definitely delays things.
Right. Okay. So then I'm just curious then about, you know, what in your view does Lending Club need to do, and what can third-party providers like you guys do to help get investors more comfortable so that they, particularly first-time investors, you know, who are now, you know, a lot of them are delaying. So what should they do, and what can you guys do to help?
So one of the things we're seeing recently, and it's not just, it's starting to happen prior to the Lending Club news, is there seems to be a growing divergence of platform performance. So some platforms still are able to underwrite well and have good results in terms of expected returns for investors. But and we get involved in due diligence pretty regularly, and we do see some platforms do well, but there are some other platforms that sometimes the return is just not up to par. So for us, being an independent evaluator of the space for platforms, we think we help investors separate the good from the bad. Warren Buffett, you know, he once had a quote saying, only when the tide goes out, you discover who's swimming butt naked.
Right.
Yes. This definitely applies to platforms. I think the stronger platforms are going to continue being stronger, you know, despite some of the short-term headlines and potential setbacks. But longer term, the good fundamentals in the business and the good performance will prevail and will help that process.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I want to go back to something you said earlier, and that is around delinquencies. You said like there were some issues in 2015, and you know, we've obviously had several interest rate hikes at the platform since then. So I guess, what are you seeing today, like from first quarter, even early, I mean, anything from the second quarter, which is obviously not even finished yet, but what are you seeing as far as how are delinquencies tracking? Have the platforms kind of moved beyond the challenges that they had in 2015?
I guess I'll answer in that at two parts. So in terms of current performance, the portfolio level delinquencies, it's not really coming down just yet. And a big part of that is the need to still work through some of the weak originations, like starting Q4 2014 and even Q1, Q2 2015. There are some pockets of, I guess Lending Club calls them pockets of weakness. And I think that's the right term. It's not across the board, but there are certainly some segments that weren't underwritten as well as we think they should have been.
But isn't it before you go on, yeah. Isn't there always going to be pockets of weakness? Because you're not going to have a perfect underwriting model. Are you saying that there's pockets of weakness that is more than what they should be, or more than average, shall we say?
Yeah, pockets of weakness, and that's Lending Club's term. And for us, what we're seeing was some segments that you think should have been more static. It just seems like there were proportionally more weaker borrowers coming in for some of those vintages. And I mean, obviously not without reasons, right? Again, thinking back for a while, a big challenge was there being too much capital coming in and hot money coming into the space and needing to buy loans. And I think that probably has some pressure on the platforms to originate more and probably cause some of the weaker underwriting. I guess the irony of it is looking at the origination in Q2, I mean, obviously it's still early, but just the underwriting criteria and the expected returns, you know, I guess that also includes the rates, the lending rates, the coupons. When you combine everything together, these new originations are looking better than they have been in quite a few quarters.
Mm-hmm.
So we're actually fairly bullish about the new originations because the criteria is now better. And I would like to think people have learned their lessons, and it's borne out by the numbers and some of the quantitative measures.
Yeah, well, it'll be interesting to see because, you know, right now, you know, you saw there was news a week or two ago that, you know, Prosper's not buying on Credit Karma or LendingTree, and, you know, and I'm sure that their direct mail is down. I mean, when you have, you know, these platforms, some of them are, you know, we don't know exactly how far Lending Club's down. We won't find that out for a while, but, you know, assuming they're down 50%, shall we say, which I don't think is unreasonable, and it's probably more than that, but assuming they're down 50%, you know, I imagine that when you're doing your marketing spend, you can tighten your criteria, and, you know, maybe that's what they've done with, if they're increasing the interest rates, borrowers are paying more. Borrowers don't really like paying that much more, but, you know, you can tighten your criteria much more readily when you have smaller loan volumes. And so I guess my question is that what you're seeing in the second quarter, or is there something else in play?
We definitely see a tightening of criteria. So we had a blog post recently about this tightening of criteria that Lending Club announced, and kind of almost in a footnote in their quarterly earnings release. I mean, obviously, nobody read that far into the quarterly earnings release beyond the unfortunate headlines, but it was telling. And specifically, they were eliminating some of the worst performing segments. And we definitely saw that in the data in terms of borrowers they eliminated from their criteria. And also keeping in mind, they're not doing this in isolation. I think the fact that different lenders, different originators, many of them are under the similar competitor pressure before. Everyone kind of had to loosen their criteria. Not had to, but there was more pressure. Now that there were fewer loans being given out, that's healthier from the perspective of being able to have a tighter underwriting criteria and ultimately better for investors.
Yep. No, I think that's it's going to be interesting to see once the investor demand comes back, because, you know, I expect it will, and I imagine you do as well. But when the investor demand comes back, how are the platforms going to deal with this? Are we going to see back to the same way? I'm hopeful that we've all learned our lesson. You know, it'll be interesting to see. I mean, what are your thoughts on that? When, you know, if and when we get back to, you know, this sort of rapid growth. And I think the days of like 100% growth annually for the larger platforms, I'm guessing, is pretty much over. But, you know, even growing at, you know, 40 or 50% a year is still, that's a lot of new borrowers coming on board. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
I think a large part of what was missing before was investor diligence. And certainly I don't mean to say all investors, like, I didn't mean to say none of the investors were paying attention, but certainly when I think sometime in 2015, when there was pressure to quickly get the deals done and get them out the door, there was certainly less diligence from the investor side. Now that I think there will be more pressure for investors to look more closely, I think that creates the right incentives for both investors and ultimately the platforms, because it's investors that ultimately drive the disclosure and the behavior, not the other way around.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Very good point, James. So I got to let you go. Before I do so, just give us some updates on Monja and what you're working on, and what are some of the things we can expect from you guys in the future?
Sure. Our plan is really to stay focused and to stay focused on services that help investors add value and really, again, back to what I said earlier, services that help with the investment process, help select the right platforms and the right loans. So this means, you know, certainly risk management, pricing, and different types of analytics, including potentially secondary market. Look, we're not building a secondary market. We don't think that's our strong suit, but we're pretty excited that companies like Orchard is focusing on on this. And earlier in the year, we were involved in a couple transactions where we help evaluate the longs on the secondary market. And I think longer term, this is one area that will grow quite a bit more if the asset class were to be mature and to attract more institutional capital. So we're excited about potential developments in this area. But I guess fundamentally, we are really bullish about the asset class. Despite the headlines, the fundamentals, they haven't been hurt. And in some cases, they're better than before. So we're hopeful there.
Yep, I completely agree with you there, James. I'm also obviously very bullish on this. So on that note, I'll have to let you go. I very much appreciate your time today, James.
Appreciate your time.
Okay, see ya.
Thank you. See ya.
In many ways, I think today is just a great time to be investing on these platforms, particularly with Lending Club and Prosper, because they've increased their interest rates. They have, you know, tightened up their underwriting a little bit. And, you know, returns are going to be better, most likely, if, you know, barring an unforeseen, you know, major recession or something. If we keep kicking along the way we have been, returns are probably going to be higher from loans issued for the rest of this year than they were for the last half of 2015. And so I think, as I said, this bodes well for investors, and I think it bodes well for the industry. We can certainly use some good news and use, you know, some positive momentum here. Hopefully this will be the upside of all that. Anyway, on that note, I will sign off. I very much appreciate you listening, and I'll catch you next time. Bye.